But over the 20th century, lecterns, or podiums, got bigger and bigger to accommodate a light for the script, buttons to advance slides, and, more recently, a laptop. There was even a theory that by blocking out most of the speaker's body, so you could only see her face, you were boosting her authority, perhaps by unconscious association with a preacher in a pulpit. Whether deliberate or unintentional, the effect of larger lecterns has been to create a huge visual barrier between speaker and audience. From a speaker's point of view, this can be very comfortable. What's not to like? All you need for your talk is right there at your fingertips. And you feel personally secure. The fact that you forgot to shine your shoes or that your shirt is a little wrinkled just doesn't matter. No one can see that. Do you have awkward body language or bad posture? No problem. The lectern hides that too. Pretty much all that's visible is your face. Phew! And hurrah! But from the audience's point of view, there's a big loss here. We spent a whole chapter talking about the importance of making a connection between audience and speaker. And a significant part of that is driven by the speaker's willingness to be vulnerable. It's an unspoken but powerful interaction. If a speaker lets down his guard, so does the audience. If a speaker stays distant and safe, the audience will too. TED's co-founder Richard Saul Wurman was adamant on this point. No podiums, no lecterns, no reading of speeches. He disliked anything that turned the relationship between audience and speaker into something formal. That included the wearing of ties, which he banned outright. When one speaker, Nicholas Negroponte, demurred and showed up in a suit and tie, Richard strode on stage with a pair of scissors and cut off the tie. That stance is one of the reasons why TED conferences felt different from what people were used to. Speakers were forced to be vulnerable, and audiences responded. If you can get comfortable with it, a talk given in front of an audience with no lectern in the way is the best approach. The vast majority of TED Talks are like this, and we encourage everyone to give it a try. But there are trade-offs, and in today's TED, we've concluded that there are multiple ways to give a talk, both for variety's sake and to meet the needs of a given speaker. It's good for speakers to push the edge of their comfort zone, but as I described earlier, you can also go too far. I learned from Daniel Kahneman and others that letting someone speak in a setup that makes him feel confident and allows him to most naturally find the words he needs matters even more than maximizing vulnerability. So the purpose of this chapter is to help you understand the full set of trade-offs and then find the speaking mode that is best for you. The key first question. In order to give your talk effectively, how many notes will you need to refer to? If you have it memorized completely, or you can deliver it from a short, handwritten set of bullet points, the choice is simple. Go out on stage and give the talk direct, human to humans. No lectern, nothing in the way, just you, a single handheld note card, and the audience. In many ways, this is the gold standard to aim for. It's your best chance at building a powerful connection with your listeners, building on your perceived vulnerability. But not everyone can get comfortable with this approach, and perhaps not every talk justifies the time it takes to do well in this situation. So, if you think you need a lot more notes, or even a full script, what then? Here's a list of possibilities that offer progressively more support, but some are much better than others. Comfort backup. In this mode, before going on stage, you place a full set of notes, or even a script, on a table or lectern at the side or back of the stage, along with a bottle of water. You then seek to deliver the talk from the front of the stage as above, knowing that if you get stuck, you can move to your notes, take a sip of water, and continue. From an audience point of view, this is completely natural and non-problematic. By having the notes at a distance from you, you'll avoid the temptation of looking down at every instance, and chances are good that you will get through the talk without even having to use them. But it takes away a lot of pressure just to know they're there. Slides as guides. Many speakers use their slides as memory nudges. We've discussed this briefly earlier in the book. What you mustn't do, of course, is to use PowerPoint as a full outline of your talk and deliver a series of text-crammed slides. That's awful. But if you have elegant images to accompany every key step of your talk, this approach can work very well, provided that you've thought about each transition. The images act as terrific memory nudges, though you may still need to carry a card with additional notes. Handheld note cards. Maybe you have too much to fit on a single card. You want to remind yourself what the transition is to each slide, the key examples that go under each main bullet point, or the exact phrasing of your closing. In that case, the best bet may be to use a set of handheld 5x8-inch cards, which you simply page through one by one. It's best to have them on a ring clip in case you drop them and they get out of sequence. These cards are unobtrusive, but they allow you to easily check where you are in your talk. The only downside is if you rarely need to refer to them and then have to page through 5 or 6 to catch up with your next point. An alternative is a clipboard or full-size sheets of paper. They require fewer page turns, but overall seem more intrusive. Cards are probably better, and if your talk relies a lot on visuals, a good approach is one card per slide that includes the transition text to the following slide. All this being said, it's still important to know your talk pretty well, so you're not constantly looking down. Many TED speakers use note cards. You may not see them on screen, but that's partly because our editors have done a good job disguising them, and partly because most speakers use them only as occasional support. The power of this approach is that it frees you to walk the stage unencumbered while still carrying with you all you need in terms of keeping the talk on track. Smartphone or tablet. Some speakers have taken to using smart devices as a high-tech replacement for note cards. Instead of multiple cards, they figure they can simply scroll through their talk. This approach can certainly grant someone freedom from the lectern, but I'm not crazy about it. For one thing, when someone's looking at a screen, we unconsciously associate that with their being disconnected from us. All that texting is to blame. In addition, there are many things that can slow this down. A single accidental touch on the screen can take you away from your script, and it may take a lot of scrolling and peering to find your place. Perhaps someone will come up with a perfect app to fix this, but so far, as used in real-world conditions, the solution seems slower and clumsier than old-fashioned note cards. It's fine to have your script on an iPad and to use it as a comfort backup, but I don't recommend using a smart device for notes you regularly refer to. Confidence monitors. Many higher-end speaking venues will have a couple of confidence monitors in your field of vision, either angled up from the floor of the stage, or perhaps at the back of the room above the audience. The main purpose of these is to allow you to see that your slide has advanced without your having to constantly turn around. But they can also be used to display, for your eyes only, notes you've added to a slide and or the next slide due up so that you can be ready. PowerPoint and Keynote both support this feature with presenter view. There are obvious advantages here. If you've structured your talk to have one slide per topic, you can use confidence monitors to keep yourself comfortably on track. But there are also significant traps you can fall into. Sometimes speakers look at the wrong monitor, confuse the next and current slide screens, and panic that the wrong slide is showing. But much worse is the tendency to become too dependent on the notes on these screens and to be constantly referring to them. This is actually more off-putting than a speaker looking down at notes. Unless the confidence monitors have been placed right in the middle of the audience, you can clearly see when a speaker is looking at the screens. Either their eyes are constantly dropping to the stage floor, or they're lifting above the heads of the audience. It can become deeply off-putting, the very opposite of the sought-after eye contact that builds recognition. Besides, there's something familiar and comfortable about a speaker occasionally referring to notes. The notes are right there, and everyone can see what he's doing. It's no problem. But when his eyes move to a confidence monitor, it can quickly become distancing. You may not notice it early in a talk, but as it continues to happen, you, as an audience member, start to feel a little awkward. It's a bit like the uncanny valley I referred to earlier. Things are almost right, but not quite, and the gap feels weird. This can get really bad when a speaker tries to read an entire speech from confidence monitors. The first 2 minutes of the talk are great, but then it starts to dawn on people that they're being read to, and somehow the life is then sucked from the talk. We had a distressing instance of this at TED a decade ago, when a sports celebrity came to give a talk and persuaded us he needed the full text of the speech on screens at the back of the room. The words he spoke were perfectly fine, but you could track his eyes reading 3 feet above everyone's heads, and it killed the talk's impact stone dead. The only speaker I've ever seen read effectively off confidence monitors is the singer Bono. He's a natural performer, and he managed to read out of the edge of his field of vision while maintaining lots of eye contact with the audience, a natural tone of voice, and pleasant injections of humour. But even then, people who noticed that the words of the speech, including the jokes, were right there on the monitors at the back of the hall, were disappointed. They wanted Bono's mind live there with them. A written speech could have been emailed to them. Our strong recommendation for use of confidence monitors is use them only to show your slides, the same slides the audience is seeing. If you must add notes, use as few as possible, and with just 2 or 3 word bullet points. And then practice giving the talk with the absolute minimum number of glances at those monitors. No reading. That's the only way to stay warmly connected to the audience. Teleprompter or auto-cue. If confidence monitors are dangerous, a teleprompter is even more so. On the face of it, it's a brilliant invention. It places the words on a glass screen invisible to the audience, but right in the speaker's line of sight. So a speaker can read a speech while also maintaining constant eye contact with the audience. But its ingenuity is also its Achilles heel. If you use one of these, you're in danger of communicating to the audience, "I'm pretending to look at you, but actually I'm reading." And the mixed signals from that can be damaging. You might object, "This can't be right. President Obama, one of the finest speakers of our era, regularly uses a teleprompter." Indeed. And it has a divisive effect on audiences. Those disposed to trust and like him ignore it and embrace the talk in full as his authentic way of speaking to them. But his political opponents have gleefully used the teleprompter against him, mocking him for not being able to speak openly to live audiences. As a result, media strategist Fred Davis believes the teleprompter has been ruined for all politicians. He told the Washington Post, "It's a negative because it's a sign of inauthenticity. It's a sign that you can't speak on your own 2 feet. It's a sign that you have handlers behind you telling you what to say." At TED, we're reluctant to make hard and fast rules these days, but we always discourage the use of teleprompters on the main stage. Today's audiences would rather have a speaker do his best job with memory, notes, and in-the-moment thinking than do a perfect job that mixes reading with fake eye contact. So what do you do if you need a full script of your talk, but you can't read it off confidence monitors or a teleprompter for fear of seeming inauthentic? Here's our suggestion. Unobtrusive lectern. If you must refer to a full script, lengthy notes, a laptop, or a tablet, don't fake it. Just go back to putting them on a lectern. But at least see if the event organizer can provide a cool, modern, unobtrusive lectern, one that is transparent, or has a thin stem as opposed to a heavy wooden one that screens out your entire body. Then commit to knowing the talk really well so that you can spend lots of time looking out at the audience instead of down at the lectern. For Monica Lewinsky's talk, this proved the perfect solution. For her, the stakes were too great to risk memorizing the entire thing. In rehearsal, she tried referring to her notes from confidence monitors, but we really didn't think that approach was working. She kept looking out above the audience's heads, and it broke their connection with her. Happily, Monica came up with something we'd never tried at TED before, but which worked perfectly. She propped her notes on a music stand. If you watch her talk, you'll see that it doesn't remove her from the audience one bit. In fact, she rarely looks down at it, but it gave her all the confidence she needed to truly shine. Why does this work better than confidence monitors or a teleprompter? Because there's no ambiguity about what's happening. It's honest and familiar. The audience can enjoy the fact that you're clearly making an effort not to read the speech, looking around, making eye contact, smiling, and being natural. And if this makes you more comfortable and confident, people will hear that in your voice and will relax with you. So, those are your main choices. You can, of course, always invent something unique to you. Clifford Stoll had 5 bullet points for his talk, and wrote 1 on each finger and his thumb. Every time he changed topic, the camera would zoom in to a close-up of his hand, and we'd get his view of what was next. It was quirky and endearing. What matters is that you find the talk mode that works for you. Commit to it early and practice it as best you can, using the exact same props that you'll be using on stage. That, by the way, is another ding against too much dependency on confidence monitors. You can never be 100% sure that the onstage setup is the same as what you've rehearsed with. In short, it's okay to be vulnerable. It's also okay to find your place of comfort and confidence. And it's essential to be authentic. 17. Voice and presence. Give your words the life they deserve. Here's a radical question. Why bother to give a talk? Why not, instead, simply email the text to every potential member of the audience? An 18-minute talk contains maybe 2,500 words. Many people can read 2,500 words in less than 9 minutes and retain good comprehension. So why not do that instead? Save the auditorium cost, save everyone's travel, save the chance that you might flub your lines and look foolish, and get your talk across in less than half the time it takes to speak it. In my 20s, I couldn't have made the case for public speaking. While studying philosophy at university, I was devastated to find that the wonderful P.F. Strawson, a beautiful writer and brilliant thinker, was, at least on the day I heard him, a truly terrible speaker. He mumbled his way through 60 minutes, reading every sentence in the same monotone voice, barely looking up. I learned that I was utterly wasting my time going to his lectures when I could double down on just reading his books. So I stopped going to his lectures. In fact, I stopped going to lectures, period. I just read. One of the reasons I was so captivated by TED was the discovery that talks really can offer something more than the printed word. But it's not a given, and it's not even true in every case. That something extra has to be thought about, invested in, developed. It has to be earned. What is that something extra? It's the human overlay that turns information into inspiration. Think of a talk as two streams of input running parallel. Words are processed by your brain's language engine, which operates in much the same way when you're listening as when you're reading. But layered on top is a stream of metadata that allows you to, largely unconsciously, evaluate every piece of language you're hearing, determines what you should do with it, and how you should prioritize it. There's no analog to this in reading. It can only happen when you're watching a speaker and hearing her voice. Here are some of the impacts that the added layer can bring. Connection. I trust this person. Engagement. Every sentence sounds so interesting. Curiosity. I hear it in your voice and see it in your face. Understanding. The emphasis on that word with that hand gesture. Now I get it. Empathy. I can tell how much that hurt you. Excitement. Wow, that passion is infectious. Conviction. Such determination in those eyes. Action. I want to be on your team. Sign me up. In the aggregate, this is inspiration. Inspiration in its broadest sense. I think of it as the force that tells the brain what to do with a new idea. Many ideas just get filed away and probably soon forgotten. Inspiration, by contrast, grabs an idea and rushes it into our mind's attention spotlight. General alert! Important new worldview incoming! Prepare to activate! There are many mysteries in how and why we respond so powerfully to certain speakers. These capabilities have evolved over hundreds of thousands of years and are deeply wired into us. Somewhere inside you, there is an algorithm for trust, an algorithm for credibility, an algorithm for how emotions are spread from one brain to another. We don't know the details of those algorithms, but we can agree on important clues. And they break down into two big categories. What you do with your voice and what you do with your body. Speak with meaning. If you get a chance, listen to the opening minute of the TED Talk by George Monbiot. The text is charming, but not particularly sensational. When I was a young man, I spent 6 years of wild adventure in the tropics, working as an investigative journalist in some of the most bewitching parts of the world. I was as reckless and foolish as only young men can be. This is why wars get fought. But I also felt more alive than I've ever done since. And when I came home, I found the scope of my existence gradually diminishing until loading the dishwasher seemed like an interesting challenge. And I found myself sort of scratching at the walls of life as if I was trying to find a way out into a wider space beyond. I was, I believe, ecologically bored. But when he speaks, you hear something quite different.
When I was a young man, I spent 6 years of wild adventure in the tropics, working as an investigative journalist in some of the most bewitching parts of the world. I was as reckless and foolish as only young men can be. This is why wars get fought. But I also felt more alive than I've ever done since. And when I came home, I found the scope of my existence gradually diminishing until loading the dishwasher seemed like an interesting challenge. And I found myself sort of scratching at the walls of life, as if I was trying to find a way out into a wider space beyond. I was, I believe, ecologically bored.
When you hear Monbiot speak, you find yourself pulled instantly into his world. Almost every word he utters is crafted with a different layer of tone or meaning embedded in it. And the net effect is to add incredible nuance to his opening, nuance that print simply can't impart. That talent continues throughout the talk. The words he was uttering evoked intrigue and curiosity, to be sure, but his voice practically forced you to feel curiosity and astonishment. How did he do this? Voice coaches speak of at least 6 tools you can use. Volume, pitch, pace, timbre, tone, and something called prosody, which is the sing-song rise and fall that distinguishes, for example, a statement from a question. If you want to dig into these a little more, I thoroughly recommend a TED Talk by Julian Treasure called How to Speak So That People Want to Listen. He not only explains what's needed, he offers exercises that help you get your own voice ready. For me, the key takeaway is simply to inject variety into the way you speak. Variety based on the meaning you're trying to convey. So many speakers forget this. They give a talk in which every sentence has the same vocal pattern, a slight rise at the start and a drop at the end. There are no pauses or changes of pace. What this communicates is that no single part of your talk matters more than any other part. It's just plodding its way along until it gets to the end. The biological effect of this is hypnotic. That is, it simply puts your audience to sleep. If your talk is scripted, try this. Find the 2 or 3 words in each sentence that carry the most significance and underline them. Then look for the 1 word in each paragraph that really matters and underline it twice more. Find the sentence that is lightest in tone in the whole script and run a light wavy pencil line under it. Look for every question mark and highlight them with a yellow highlighter. Find the biggest single aha moment of the talk and inject a great big black blob right before it is revealed. If there's a funny anecdote somewhere, put little pink dots above it. Now try reading your script, applying a change in tone for each mark. For example, let yourself smile while looking at the pink dots. Pause for the big black blob and speed up a little for the wavy pencil line while speaking more softly. How does that sound? Really contrived? Then try again with a little more nuance. Now try one more thing. Try to remember all the emotions associated with each passage of your talk. Which are the bits you're most passionate about? Which issues could make you a little angry? What are you laughing at? What are you baffled by? Now let those emotions out a little as you speak. How's it sounding? Try doing this with a friend present and see what she responds to and what she rolls her eyes at. Record yourself reading it and then play it back with your eyes closed. The point is to start thinking of your tone of voice as giving you a whole new set of tools to get inside your listeners' heads. You want them to understand you, yes, but you also want them to feel your passion. And the way you do that is not by telling them to be passionate about this topic, it's by showing your own passion. It spreads automatically, as will every other emotion you authentically feel. You were worried about the short time limit? No worries. In a sense, you just doubled it. You can use every second not just to convey information, but to communicate how that information might be received. and all without adding a single extra word. For more great examples of the right use of voice, check out talks by Kelly McGonigal, John Ronson, Amy Cuddy, Hans Rosling, and the incomparable Sir Ken Robinson. Some speaking coaches may push vocal variety beyond what feels right to you. Don't let them. Let it come naturally from the passion you feel for the topic. Mostly you want to speak conversationally, interjecting curiosity and excitement when it's appropriate. I ask people to imagine they've met up with friends they went to school with and are updating them on what they've been up to. It's that kind of voice you're looking for. Real, natural, but unafraid to let it rip if what you're saying demands it. One other important aspect to pay attention to: how fast you're speaking. First of all, it's great to vary your pacing according to what you're speaking about. When you're introducing key ideas or explaining something that's complex, slow down. And don't be afraid to insert pauses. During anecdotes and lighter moments, speed up. But overall, you should plan to speak at your natural conversational pace. For most speakers, that's somewhere in the range 130 to 170 words per minute. Some guides to public speaking urge people to deliberately slow down. In most circumstances, I think that's ill-advised. In general, understanding outpaces articulation. In other words, it usually takes the speaker's brain circuits more time to compose than the listener's to comprehend. Except for the complex explanation moments where, yes, you should slow down. If you speak at your normal conversational pace, it's fine. The listener won't mind. But if you go much slower than that, you're inviting impatience into the room. Impatience is not your friend. While you're enjoying the biggest moment of your life, the audience is slowly dying of word starvation. Rory Sutherland, who somehow maintained 17 minutes of hilarious, insightful speech at a rate of 180 words per minute, believes many speakers could benefit from speeding up a bit. There are two ways of losing an audience. Going too fast is by far the rarer of the two. Going too slowly is actually the bigger problem, since it allows time for people's minds to wander off. I feel a bit guilty saying this, but if you speak quickly enough, you can get away with the odd leaping segue. I don't recommend blatant non sequiturs, obviously. Speaking fast also papers over a lot of cracks. No one minds or even notices the odd or provided they come quick and fast. Neither he nor I is recommending that you rush or gabble. Just that you talk conversationally and be ready to accelerate in passages where it's natural to do so. This works well, both in the room and online. Does that surprise you? Do you think of public speaking as the opposite of conversational speaking? At one TED conference, a first-time speaker from South Asia started his rehearsal bellowing at the top of his voice. I'm all for variety in speaking styles, but this was really exhausting to listen to. I asked him why he was speaking that way, and he thought for a moment and said, "In my culture, public speaking means speaking to a crowd of people. For the people at the back to hear, you have to shout." But, he paused, "but here I suppose I do not need to do this, because here we have an automatic shouting device." He tapped his microphone and we burst into laughter. It's actually a really important point. Public speaking evolved long before the age of amplification. To address a crowd of any size, speakers would have to slow down, breathe deep, and let rip, with dramatic pauses after each sentence. It's a style of speaking we recognize today as oration. It's a speaking style that can sync up crowd emotions and responses in a powerful way. We associate it with some of the most influential speeches in literature and history, from Mark Antony's "Friends, Romans, Countrymen," to Patrick Henry's "Give me liberty or give me death." But in most modern settings, oration is best used sparingly. It's capable of conveying passion and urgency and outrage, but it struggles with the many more subtle emotions. And from an audience perspective, it can be really powerful for 15 minutes, but exhausting for an hour. If you were speaking to a single person, you would not orate. You could not build a day-long conference program around oration. And oration is much slower. Martin Luther King's "I Have a Dream" speech was delivered at around 100 words per minute. It was perfectly crafted and delivered for its purpose. But it's unlikely that your task today is to address a crowd of 200,000 people at the heart of a major social movement. Amplification has given us the ability to speak intimately to a crowd. It's an ability worth using. It builds connection and curiosity much more easily than oration. That conversational tone is even more important when you watch a talk online. There, you're a single person looking at a screen, and you want the speaker to address you as such. Talks that are orated to a large crowd rarely go viral. Some speakers fall into a trap here. In the thrill of being on stage, they get caught up in a slightly too grandiose sense of the occasion and begin unconsciously embracing a form of oration. They slow down their pace. They speak a little too loudly. And they insert dramatic pauses between sentences. This is an absolute talk killer. Oration is a subtle art that only a few are truly great at. It can be appropriate in church or at a mass political rally, but for other public speaking occasions, I recommend leaving it alone. Recruit your body. Sir Ken Robinson jokes that some professors seem to view their bodies simply as devices to carry their heads into the next meeting. Sometimes a speaker will give the same impression. Once his body has moved his head onto the stage, it no longer knows what to do with itself. The problem is amplified in a setting where there's no lectern to hide behind. People stand awkwardly, hands glued to their sides, or lurch from leg to leg. The last thing I want to prescribe is a single approach to body language. Talks would quickly get boring if every speaker did the same thing. But there are a few things you can think about that may make you feel more comfortable and that will better project your authority to your audience. The simplest way to give a talk powerfully is just to stand tall, putting equal weight on both feet, which are positioned comfortably a few inches apart, and use your hands and arms to naturally amplify whatever you're saying. If the audience seating is curved around the stage a little, you can turn from the waist to address different parts of it. You don't have to walk around at all. This mode can project calm authority. It is the method used by a majority of TED speakers, including Sir Ken. The key is to feel relaxed and to let your upper body move as it will. Good posture helps. Avoid slouching your shoulders forward. An open stance may feel vulnerable, but that vulnerability works in your favor. Some speakers, though, prefer to walk the stage. It helps them think. It helps them emphasize key moments. This can work well, too, provided the walking is relaxed, not forced. Take a look at Juan Enriquez in action, or Elizabeth Gilbert. In both cases, they look extremely comfortable. And, this is important, they frequently stop to dwell on a point. It's that rhythm that lets this method work. Constant pacing can be tiring to watch. Pacing punctuated by stillness can be powerful. Something to avoid is nervously shifting from leg to leg or walking forward and back a couple of steps in a kind of rocking motion. Many speakers do this without realizing it. They may be feeling a little anxious, and shifting from one leg to the other eases their discomfort. But from the audience's viewpoint, it actually highlights that discomfort. There have been so many times in TED rehearsals where we've encouraged these speakers to relax and to simply stand still. The difference in impact is immediate. So, move if you want to. But if you do move, move intentionally. And then, when you want to emphasize a point, stop and address your audience from a stance of quiet power. There are plenty of other ways you can speak with power. Dame Stephanie Shirley chose to sit for her talk using a metal stool with one foot tucked back on a rung, and notes in her lap. It looked relaxed and natural. The late great neurologist Oliver Sacks also sat for his talk. At the other end of the spectrum, Clifford Stoll leapt and darted round the stage with such energy that it added an entirely new and unique dimension to his talk. So there are no rules here, other than for you to find a mode of being on stage in which you're comfortable and confident, and which doesn't detract from what you're saying. The simple test is to rehearse in front of a small audience and ask them if your body language is getting in the way. And or video record yourself to see if you're doing something you're unaware of. The world can accommodate and welcome many different presentation styles. Just make sure your body knows it's not there solely to transport your head. It's allowed to enjoy its own time on stage. Do it your way. And now the most important lesson. It's an easy trap to get so caught up with the how of giving a talk that you forget what's more important, and that is giving your talk in your own authentic way. As with your wardrobe choice, once you've found a presentation style that works for you, don't overthink it. Don't try to be someone else. Focus on your content and your passion for it, and don't be afraid to let your own personality shine through. The success of Jill Boaty Taylor's talk back in 2008 tempted a whole generation of TED speakers to try to imitate her emotional tone. That's a mistake, and it's one that Mary Roach almost fell for. The first thing I did upon being invited to give a talk was to click on the most popular TED talk at that time, the one by Jill Boaty Taylor. I stopped it after 2 minutes because I knew I could not be Jill Boaty Taylor. As insecure as I am, I knew it would be better to be Mary Roach than to be Mary Roach trying to be Jill Boaty Taylor. Dan Pink agrees. Say it like yourself. Don't mimic someone else's style or conform to what you think is a particular TED way of presenting. That's boring, banal, and backward. Don't try to be the next Ken Robinson or the next Jill Boaty Taylor. Be the first you. 18. Format innovation. The promise and peril of full-spectrum talks. In November 2011, science writer John Bohannon took to the stage at TEDx Brussels, accompanied by an unusual speaking aid. Instead of PowerPoint, he brought with him a dance troupe. Well, actually, they brought him. They carried him onto the stage. And while he spoke about lasers and superfluids, they physically embodied the points he was making. It was a riveting performance. Bohannon went on to argue that dance can be a great accompaniment for science talks, and he's even started a movement called Dance Your PhD. If you want your talk to truly stand out from the crowd, there are many options open to you to be innovative. If we look at the fundamentals, the only real constraint in a talk is the time available. In 18 minutes, you can utter about 2,500 words. But what else could you do? Your audience has 5 senses and is capable of absorbing multiple inputs. At TED, we use the term full spectrum to describe those attempts to build more into a talk than just words and slides. Here are 16 suggestions you could consider. We suspect we're going to see enormous innovation over the coming years. Now, all of these need handling with extreme care. Done wrong, they can seem gimmicky, but done right, they can kick a talk up to a whole new level. 1. Dramatic props. 20 years ago, I saw a talk about the need to continue to fight for nuclear disarmament. I can't remember the name of the speaker, nor his organization, nor much of what he said. But I will never forget what he did. He took a single dried pea and held it up. He said, "I want you to imagine that this is a thermonuclear weapon, a hydrogen bomb. It is 1,000 times more powerful than the bomb dropped on Hiroshima." He'd tossed the pea into a large metal bucket that had a microphone attached to it. The scratchy ping when it landed and bounced was shockingly loud. Then he said, "And how many thermonuclear warheads do you think there are on Earth today?" He paused. 30,000. Without saying anything else, he reached down and picked up a sack of dried peas and tipped them into the bucket, first one at a time, then as a torrent. The sound was deafening, terrifying. At that moment, every person in that room understood deeply, viscerally, why this issue mattered. Numerous TED Talks have been elevated by the use of unexpected props. To make a point about left and right brain hemispheres, Jill Boaty Taylor brought a real human brain onto the stage, complete with dangling spinal column. There was something about the relish with which she lifted it out of its bucket that stuck in everyone's mind. It was an object of passion. Bill Gates gained headlines across the world by releasing a jar full of mosquitoes during his talk on malaria, joking, "There's no reason why only poor people should have the experience." J.J. Abrams held us riveted by bringing on stage a mystery box his grandfather had given him that he'd never opened. And, of course, he left the stage with it still unopened. If you have something you can powerfully, legitimately use, this can be a great way to make sure your talk is never forgotten. But be careful, and be sure to practice in real-world conditions. I once brought a spectacular yellow Burmese python onto the stage, wrapped around my body, to make a point about nature's awesomeness. I thought I was rocking it, until the audience started guffawing. I didn't know that Burmese pythons are heat seekers. The python had wriggled down my back, and its head had just emerged, waving to and fro from between my legs. Awesome, but not in quite the way I'd intended. 2. Panoramic screens. At TED 2015, MIT artist and designer Neri Oxman took everyone's breath away with a presentation featuring two parallel sets of images displayed simultaneously on giant screens that stretched out on either side of her. One revealed the tech side of her work, the other the more organic side. Each was impressive individually, the combination was absolutely stunning. But not just for its visual impact. It showed us, at a visceral level, the dual nature of her work as a science-based designer and artist. The Google Zeitgeist Conference is among those that have innovated ultra-widescreen presentations, allowing multiple versions of the same picture, spectacular panoramic photography, and bold lines of text stretching 100 feet on either side of the speaker. The cinematic feel of these presentations is incredible. Trickier is how to edit them for online sharing. So far, the only mass-accessible formats are the standard video shapes of 16:9 and 4:3. So these presentations can be amazing in the room, but they are harder for an online audience to fully appreciate. 3. Multisense stimulation. Some speakers have sought to push beyond mere 2D vision and stereo sound. We've had chefs fill the hall with the delicious aroma of a dish being cooked live on stage, or they have pre-distributed sample bags allowing audience members to sniff and taste. Woody Norris showed us how his invention, hypersonic sound, could be projected from the stage to individual seats in the audience, where it was audible only to the occupants of those seats. Steve Schler, a pioneer of 3D cameras, gave us an early demo of how sports could be experienced in 3D, courtesy of glasses distributed to all. Perfume designer Luca Turin used a machine to pump different scents into the room. These genre-busting talks are always interesting, but with the possible exception of 3D, will probably remain limited to just a handful of topics. However, at TED 2015, David Eagleman made the case that exotic new senses could be added through technology by training the brain to understand electrical patterns from any source, such as the weather or the stock market. Maybe some future conference will feature audiences wearing electrical vests, wired to directly experience a speaker's imagination. If anyone can invent that, please get in touch. 4. Live podcasting. One of the highlights of TED 2015 was a talk by design guru Roman Mars. But instead of walking on stage with a microphone, Mars sat down behind a mixing console. He began, "I know what you're thinking. Why does that guy get to sit down? That's because this is radio." Cue music and he's underway. Mars is the host of the popular design podcast 99% Invisible, and he gave the entire talk as if he were live mixing his podcast. Numerous audio clips and images were mixed into the talk with split-second timing. This approach gave the talk incredible vitality. Superstar DJ Mark Ronson also used a mixing desk for parts of his talk. And This American Life host Ira Glass mixes parts of his live shows from an iPad. In truth, this technique is beyond the skills of most of us, but I can see it becoming an art form all its own. It's speaker as DJ, live mixing ideas from multiple sources in real time. If you think this is a skill you could master, it might well be worth the time investment. 5. Illustrated interview. An interview can be a fine alternative to a talk. This gives you a chance to explore multiple topics with no single through line other than the speaker's work and life, and nudge the speaker to go deeper than he naturally would in a talk. This is especially true with high-profile speakers whose speeches are often written by their communications departments. At TED, we've been experimenting with an interview format that encourages some preparation by both interviewer and interviewee, while still allowing for the in-the-moment cut and thrust of a traditional interview. It's a conversation accompanied by a sequence of images that has been worked out in advance by both parties. The images act as chapter markers for the various topics to be covered, and they add refreshing reference points for the conversation. When I interviewed Elon Musk, I invited him to send me rarely seen videos illustrating key topics we wanted to talk about, such as his work on building reusable spacecraft. When the appropriate moment came, I simply played the relevant video and asked him to explain what we were looking at. It added pace and variety to the interview. Likewise, when I was due to interview Bill and Melinda Gates about their philanthropic lives together, I asked them for photographs showing their early engagement in public health issues, any visual evidence of why they decided to become philanthropists, one key graph or image each that was meaningful to them, and, because we wanted to discuss the issue of inheritance, some pictures of their family. The images they came up with allowed us to make the interview much more personal than it otherwise could have been. This format is a satisfying halfway point between talk and interview. It allows interviewees to really think about how they want to structure an idea that matters to them, and it decreases the risk of rambling or getting bogged down. I can picture lots of innovation here. For example, a talk, complete with slides, given informally by interviewee to interviewer, while the latter has the option to query any points that aren't clear live on stage while the talk is in progress. 6. Spoken word fusion. A powerful art form emerged from African-American communities in the 1970s and 80s and exploded into popular culture. Spoken word can be thought of as performance poetry. It typically combines storytelling with intricate wordplay. Spoken word artists offer an exciting extension of traditional public speaking. They don't seek to explain or persuade in the manner described in this book. Instead, they tap into a use of language that's more poetic, more primal, language that can energize, move, inform, and inspire. There are many ways of blending the spoken word genre with public speaking. Sarah Kay, Clint Smith, Malcolm London, Suhair Hamad, Shane Koizan, and Reeves are among those who've given memorable performance talks at TED. However, it's not something to take on lightly. Badly done spoken word can be excruciating. 7. Video poetry exploration. The Canadian poet Tom Conneve defined video poetry as a poetic juxtaposition of images with text and sound. Online video has ignited an explosion of experimentation in video poetry, combining every imaginable mixture of text, live footage, animation, and spoken accompaniment. This is a genre capable of lighting up a talk. When former US poet laureate Billy Collins came to TED, he presented 5 of his works that had been set to video. Unquestionably, the animations enhance the impact of his already powerful words. Shane Koizan's spoken word performance at TED was enhanced by a video backdrop created by 80 crowdsourced animators. There's huge potential in experimenting with video poetry live, either as part of a talk or as an entire performance. 8. Added musical soundtrack. Why is it that almost every movie has a musical soundtrack? Well, music intensifies every emotion. It can indicate moments of special significance. It can dial up drama, sorrow, yearning, excitement, hope. So why not consider using it in talks? Several speakers have experimented with this. When John Ronson told a chilling story about someone jailed as a suspected psychopath, Julian Treasure was behind him on stage, creating an aural backdrop. Pop-Up Magazine, which seeks to turn magazine content into live performance, regularly accompanies stories with a live string quartet or jazz trio, such as in the case of Latif Nasser, who told the amazing story of the man who invented modern pain relief. The risk in going this route, apart from the intense extra effort needed in rehearsal, is that the form may reinforce the fact that this is performance, not an in-the-moment talk. This can be distancing, And in many settings, the introduction of music may feel emotionally manipulative. Nonetheless, this seems to be fertile ground for experimentation. One route would be to incorporate musicians who can improvise based on what they're hearing live. Another would be to double down on the performance aspect and just make clear that this is how this particular talk is being delivered. 9. The Lessig Method. Law professor Lawrence Lessig has pioneered a unique style of presentation, a kind of PowerPoint on steroids. Every sentence, and almost every significant word, is accompanied by a new visual, whether just a word, a photograph, an illustration, or a visual pun. For example, here's a single 18-second passage of his 2013 TED Talk, where each click represents a slide transition. Congress has evolved a different dependence, click, no longer a dependence upon the people alone, click, increasingly a dependence upon the funders, click. Now this is a dependence too, but it's, click, different and conflicting, click, from a dependence upon the people alone, click, so long as, click, the funders are not the people, click, this is a corruption, click. This shouldn't work. The blizzard of type changes in his slides seems to violate every design rulebook. But in Lessig's hands, it's riveting. There's so much intelligence and elegance in his choice of fonts, formatting, and images that you simply get swept along in awe. He told me the reason he started presenting this way was that he was sick of people at tech conferences looking down at their screens while he was speaking. He didn't want to give them a second to look away. Lessig's presentation style is so startlingly different that some have given it its own name, the Lessig Method. If you're feeling bold, you could try emulating it, but be ready to spend a lot of time in preparation and rehearsal. And again, be careful. A lot of its brilliance is in the details and in the timing of the transitions. In the wrong hands, it can and will look clumsy and overbearing. 10. Dual presenters. In general, we discourage talks given by more than one person. These somehow seem harder for audiences to connect to. They don't know who to look at, and they may never deeply relate to either presenter. But there are exceptions where the interaction between the two presenters adds real nuance. When Beverly and Derek Joubert describe their lifelong engagement with leopards and other wildcats, the clear affection and respect between them was touching in its own right. I suspect there's plenty of room for innovation here. In most such dual presentations, when one of the speakers isn't talking, he is simply standing still or watching his partner. There are a lot of other possibilities. Gesturing, reenacting, accompanying with a musical instrument or percussion, sketching or painting, interjecting. If Lawrence Lessig had a twin brother, you could imagine them finishing each other's sentences in a way that would double the impact. This is high risk. With two presenters, preparation is much more complex. Each individual is dependent on the other, and it's easy for their contributions and transitions to feel scripted. I don't recommend trying this unless you have incredible confidence and great chemistry with someone who it would be natural to experiment with. But I do think there's possibility here. 11. New debate formats. If you are going to have two people on stage at the same time, it's usually more interesting when they're on opposite sides of an issue. Often, the best way to really understand an idea is to see it challenged. There are numerous debate formats that offer exciting ways for this to happen. One of the best is an Oxford Union format, two against two. The speakers alternate with, say, 7-minute presentations for and against a controversial proposition. After moderator or audience engagement, they each have a 2-minute wrap-up, followed by an audience vote. You can see this in action on the excellent website intelligentsquaredus.org. But there are numerous alternatives, and I'd love to see innovation here. For example, you could try a courtroom format in which each witness is cross-examined by a skillful questioner. We're planning to introduce more debates to future TED events. 12. Slide Blizzard. Many talks by photographers, artists, and designers take the form of showing a sequence of slides and talking about each one. It's a good idea, but it's easy for people to dally too long on each slide. If your talent is primarily visual, you'll probably want lots of visuals, not lots of words. So it makes sense to dial up the number of slides and dial back the number of words devoted to each one. There have been lots of attempts to systematize this. For example, at Pechakucha events, the talk format prescribes that 20 slides are shown with 20 seconds devoted to each one. The slides are advanced automatically and the speaker has to keep up. Self-proclaimed geek events at the Ignite talk series has a similar format, although in this case speaker's time is reduced to 15 seconds per slide. Both methods make for terrific, fast-moving events. There's room to innovate further still. There's no reason why every slide should have exactly the same amount of time. I would love to see presentations that fit 100 slides into 6 minutes. 12 could be pause and talk slides held for 20 seconds each. The rest could be shown in 1 second bursts and accompanied by a soundtrack or just silence. 13. Live exhibition. The ultimate extension of the slide blizzard approach is to imagine that you're not giving a talk at all. Instead, you're creating the ultimate experience of immersion in your work. Suppose you're a photographer, artist, or designer who's been given a show in the main exhibition hall of one of the world's great art galleries. What would you want that experience to be? Imagine people moving from work to work, the lighting perfect, carefully created captions on each work to give them just the right amount of context. Now, why can't you recreate that experience live on stage? Think of your words not as words from a talk, but as words designed